Moving to the question I am supposed to ask you, has there been a thought about how the transition from support coordinators to navigators will be managed without creating a gap in services during the transition? Support coordination hasn't had a price increase for 4 years and is really struggling, barely sustainable at the moment. How will we make sure providers don't wind down before the new system is actually ready?
So I'll start the ball rolling on this one. Please don't wind down, right? I'm saying to every NDS member, don't wind down. The reason being, the recommendation is for navigators. You know, we all know now there's this recommendation to have navigators. And to have navigators for all people with disability. So the thing is, this area is going to grow. Like, jobs are just going to grow and grow and grow and grow. And they're growing anyway because, you know, the scheme's growing at, what, 13, 15%. It's going to be 8%. The states have now doubled their growth funding, took from 4% to 8%. You know, jobs are just going to grow. But in this area, they're going to doubly grow because there's going to be this new investment in foundational support. And those navigators are really folks who are going to be doing what good support coordinators are doing already. You know, the skills that a support coordinator has at the moment are the skills to be a navigator. We've just called them navigator because we wanted to be clear that this is something for all people with disability. And then we've called for specialist navigators in some areas. So, for example, for kids, you know, for children, that a family might have access to what we're calling a lead practitioner, which you could see as a key worker. Even the people who are going to do the assessments and so on are going to be more highly skilled than, way more highly skilled than they are now. So there's jobs for everybody. And what we've also said in the review is, of course, the transition has to be managed impeccably. You know, it's got to be managed incredibly carefully. And we did, you know, we did work closely with the NDIA throughout the course of the review. I think we frightened them a bit with the scope of the recommendations. But, you know, the point is that they have to sequence it correctly, and that people with disability and providers and workers need to be involved in each step. So you need to be involved in that transition to navigators. But I don't think it's going to look madly different. However, there is two big differences. It will be commissioned, so navigators will be commissioned by the NDIA. Navigators won't have to be funded out of someone's plan, which is good. So I think, you know, I think there's just a lot of opportunity. And I think it'll be easy to grab that opportunity because of the growth. Yeah.
Okay, one of the findings that you began discussing with the sector fairly early was around the need to get away from seeing disability supports as either in the NDIS or actually none at all, rather than just out of the NDIS. And in particular, you've called out services for children and young people and their families, noting that this support needs to return to more natural settings where children and their families live their lives. It appears that the states and Commonwealth have reached some agreement on how foundational support should work, although more work to be done. So how do you see this playing out, not just for children and families, but for more generally for groups, other groups like people with psychosocial disabilities? And what do you think has been agreed so far, and what will that mean for the reform architecture that you're suggesting?
So look, I mean, there's actually a lot of detail in our report around the nature of foundational supports. You know, you've highlighted two areas, one being children, and I'll come back and talk about that in a moment. The second area is people with psychosocial disability, where we've backed in the recommendations from the Mental Health Productivity Commission inquiry in 2020, and there's already work underway on how that might be implemented. But, you know, we've also identified people with adults with disability with lower support needs and the need for them to get help with a bit of cleaning or cooking or gardening. You know, it's a bit like the home and community care services that existed pre-NDIS and still exist in aged care. We've identified the need for adolescents to have support if they're outside the NDIS, particularly as, you know, they're gaining independence and moving from school, you know, that transition into adulthood. And then we've also looked at the ILC program and, you know, we've agreed with others that this is a short-term grants program. It's, you know, that short-term nature, the fact that it's in the fact that there's not enough of it are both sort of major problems. So we've identified a need both to restructure and effectively double the size of that program. So I think it's really, in a sense, up to governments about how they approach that. But, you know, we would say that the reforms in the area of children are particularly pressing because, you know, we know that kids' developmental delays and concerns are not being picked up quickly enough. They're not being picked up in the settings in which they, you know, they live, they learn, they play. And so ensuring that maternal health and child centres, that integrated early intervention centres for kids, children and family centres, you know, ensure that their screening methods pick up developmental delays and concerns much sooner is really critical to good long-term outcomes. It's also critical to a more sustainable scheme, you know. And so that, and then providing supports through foundational supports, through the navigators, through the lead practitioners in these community settings is absolutely critical to doing the right thing by these kids. And then, you know, ensuring best outcomes for them and in the process, you know, helping the scheme to be more sustainable. So if you were asking me, and this is a personal view, you know, that would be very high, you know, on my list of things where governments just need to act and act quickly because we sort of know what's happening. In the absence of the NDIS, you know, or in the absence of that particular foundational support, you know, the NDIS is the oasis in the desert. Everyone comes to it. And, you know, as we say in our report, if we had kids of that age, that's exactly what we would be doing. So it's entirely rational. So it has to provide a sufficient response that meets the needs of these kids so that, you know, the NDIS is not the only lifeboat, and that's, of course, where National Cabinet's decision is just so significant. Because, you know, neither Lisa, you know, Lisa and I had hopes about what might happen with our report, but then, like, the day before it released, the governments have come together to agree to it. Oh, that's...
That was awesome.
Prescient, you might say.
Prescient. Well, you know, they've signed up for to support 50-50 between the Commonwealth and states, foundational and investment in foundational support. And that investment will need to be large, and it will smooth the path that now is, you know, just the NDIS. Yeah, yeah.
And people have sort of focused on the 50-50, you know, just on the financial aspects of that deal. As Lisa mentioned earlier, it's the alignment of interest that is actually what's most important, that they are 50-50 partners on foundational support. So you've got the Commonwealth there saying, look, these are the national benchmarks we want. And then you've got states there saying, hang on, but look, you know, we need to take account of these local differences. Because quite clearly, the way you think about foundational supports in the ACT versus the Northern Territory is going to be quite different. So, you know, that partnership goes to the quality of what we hope will be delivered.
Brilliant, thank you. So, turning to implementation, which is a key one. It's been top of NDS's policy agenda, the number one thing that we think it's important to get right. In addition to the review, the sector is managing multiple reform agendas with the Disability Royal Commission, significant industrial relations reform. We heard about the employment reforms earlier. So our State of the Sector report shows a sector willing and able to engage with reform, but pretty tired and facing significant financial pressures. Against this background, it feels as if we're a little bit in a Goldilocks dilemma. We need to get the pace of change just right, too fast, and we risk poor implementation and communication too slow, and the sector is likely to become more fatigued and we might lose sight of what we want to achieve. How do you see this working in practical terms for people with disability, the government and the community? And how would you most like to see providers engage with the blueprint for change that you've proposed?
Yeah, so we've said that we think this transition needs to be about 5 years. We talk about if you get all the way to the end of the review, you'll find the chapter that says talks about implementation. Very, very conscious of what needs to happen. And we've said again and again and again in all of the products and all of our communication and in all of the engagements we've had that people with disability and people that love them and representative organisations and workers and providers need to be part of the implementation. And so we've offered a blueprint, but we haven't said that this is exactly how it'll be done because nothing about us without us. So there's a job to be done. We've also made some recommendations about potential pieces of governance to help drive that. So we have recommended that there be a new intergovernmental agreement to either beef up Australia's disability strategy or to replace it or to sit above it or whatever, that brings everything under one roof because the current arrangements just don't really lead us as far as we will need to go. But we've also called on we've recommended a couple of new pieces of what we might call architectural bodies. One is a council of folks with disability and providers and so on to help drive the implementation. So there needs to be a bit of a body that's advising DSS and the agency and the commission. And we've also recommended something we're calling a Disability Outcomes Council, which would actually keep governments honest. So it would be a bit like whatever the work is done. So closing the gap is the closing the gap targets, and those measures are reported publicly in a very high status, very public way every year. And that's overseen by a council of peaks in the First Nations communities. It's that sort of idea that you'd have providers, people with disability, probably some measurement experts, etc., actually looking at the pace of change and looking at the extent to which Australia is becoming more inclusive, as big as that. So I think if we get the governance right, the sequencing right, so the steps make sense, and the timing right so that everyone has enough time, it is reaching that Goldilocks point, enough time but not too much time that they fall over in the meantime, right? We should be okay, but it's a big one.
Yeah, look, the only thing I'd add to what Lisa said is that it's really important here that whatever timetable is set is not done on a set and forget basis. You know, that there needs to be, through all of this, data collected, evidence, and then adjustments made. Because, just with the original scheme, you put all your effort in, and with this review, you put all your effort in to get it right. But when you actually come to implement, certain things don't turn out as expected, and so it's really important that that whole philosophy that really applied in the trial period of the NDIS about listen, learn, reform, deliver listen, you know, like that's, you know, that cycle of, because people will say it's not working. So you've got to listen to that, you've got to learn from it, you've got to adjust, and then you've got to deliver it, and then do the cycle again.
Faster.
Faster.
Well, I think we are all looking forward, with a little trepidation, but looking forward to working with the government on the blueprint that you have put out. And I just really want to finish by saying thank you. Thank you first for getting the report out last week, so we had something to talk about today.
Perfectly timed. We just did it for the conference, right?
Thank you, yes. but also, thank you very much for coming today and talking to our members and really you know, letting us know what you think about the report and how things are going, and for the huge amount of work that you undertook throughout the NDIS review. We genuinely think you have arrived at a very good place, so thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Laurie. And can I just thank everybody in this room, not just for what you've done for this review, but what you've done for, and do for people with disability every day. I go back to the Every Australian Counts campaign, and I thank everybody for all the providers who funded that campaign. You know, without you, we would not have an NDIS. Without your forbearance and commitment and dedication, and the commitment and dedication of your staff, we would not have made it through the last 10 years. And I just want to thank you for what I know you're going to do in the future. This is really a journey together, but it's a journey that has the potential to give Australia the best disability system in the world. And so, you know, as well as being hard work, it's also extraordinarily exciting and privileged to be in this sort of environment and to have, you know, the commitment of governments in the way we saw it last week. It really is, I think, an extraordinary time, and it's for all of us to make sure that we don't waste this opportunity. I know we won't, but, you know, it's how do we maximise this opportunity for the people we all serve? So thank you.
Hear, hear.